Welcome to the Agile Revolution. This is Craig.
And this is Tony.
We're at Yao 2015, aren't we, Tony?
Again. It's been a year, and we're back.
We are. And it's a great pleasure to have Don Reinerston with us. How are you doing, Don?
I'm doing well, thank you.
So for those who have been living under a rock somewhere and don't know who Don is, you've read the book, haven't you, Tony?
I have indeed.
Principles of Product Development.
Principles of Product Flow.
Yeah. Don, why does it have a waterfall on the front? That's the question I've been itching to ask.
Because software people don't really understand how waterfalls work, right? Is that the when they say the waterfall model is a bad model, they're talking about the stagnant pools of water between the waterfall. Actually, a waterfall converts potential energy into kinetic energy, a constantly increasing amount of kinetic energy and things like that. And if you had a development process that was constantly reaching higher and higher levels of velocity as you went from one end to the other, I don't think that is a dysfunction in software.
Yeah, so basically you're saying it's just the way that someone drew it 35 years ago was the problem.
Somebody called waterfall with interspersed pools of water a waterfall.
Well, there you go. That's always bugged me. One of the most influential books in Agile has got a big waterfall in front, so there you know.
I never noticed, so well done.
So I guess you're going back. You started all the way back in the military, which I assume is what started you down this whole journey of, you know, starting to understand flow.
That's kind of interesting. It probably, let's say, it has informed my journey a lot, very clearly, but it really didn't sort of start me on on the issue of flow and things like that. It was actually probably in about around the 82 time frame when I was a consultant at McKinsey, that because I had a technical background and an MBA, I was assigned to these technology-based projects. And I was doing these analyses where I would try to, I'd say, the company was going to do a project and we would ask the question, what do they have to do right? So I did a sensitivity analysis. What would happen if I missed the cost target, missed the sell price, missed the schedule? And all of a sudden, missed the schedule turned out to be a big number. So I said, I need to do that analysis again. That's when I first started doing the cost delay. And then I started getting really interested in what sort of things shorten development cycles. And I started writing about that in the early 80s. Hmm. And after I left McKinsey, I was doing manufacturing turnaround work. I went to work for a guy who would buy broken companies and fix them. So I got very interested in, you know, what is the state of the art in manufacturing today? And in 1985, it was something called Japanese manufacturing techniques. That was about 10 years before MIT rebranded it as lean manufacturing. And I thought, wow, these are really good, some non-obvious ideas. I started seeing some of the similarity between what we do in product development, like concurrent engineering. What we were labeling as concurrent engineering, where we start one activity before we finish, we start the second activity before we finish the first. Another way of describing that was, instead of transferring a large batch at the end of the first activity to start the second batch, we're going to transfer a series of small batches between activity one and activity two. So I found the manufacturing vocabulary turned out to be very useful for thinking about the development processes, but it also opened up, you know, access to a whole body of knowledge that was around of saying, okay, so what is the correct batch size? That's a trade-off between transaction cost. And when we were talking about concurrent engineering, we weren't worried about the math of batch size. We were just approaching it qualitatively. But when you start tapping into the body of knowledge from manufacturing, you start saying, oh, there's some math here that you can actually use to make more studied decisions on some of these things.
Yeah, I had the pleasure of doing 2 years with some of the guys from Toyota.
Oh, okay.
So it was an interesting experience. But one of the things that I struggled with at the time was actually converting the actual manufacturing stuff into the software and product development world. It wasn't until I started reading some of the books, and I picked up yours, that I started to actually make the assemblies of where we could start using. I think one of the foibles of the manufacturing world's the way they word things is sometimes it doesn't come across into
another root cause, which is the guy who created the Toyota production system, Taichi Ono, hated math. I mean, he was an inveterate tinkerer. He would go, what he liked to do is sit around on the factory floor and tweak processes. You know, pick up a little improvement here, a little improvement there. He didn't like theory. He didn't like number. The only numbers he ever liked was a production report. And there's a wonderful book on the origins of lean and things like that, where they interview people who worked with him. But it didn't really start. It wasn't a theory driven approach, which is not bad. Being empirically driven to start out is okay. But the problem is sometimes you need to step back and say, why does this work? So you can make it transportable into other domains. And I think the big shortcoming and I think a lot of the lean manufacturing stuff is they don't really have much of a mathematical view on what they're doing. And as a result, it tends to make it harder for people to say, how do I adjust the knobs when I move this to a different domain?
Is that because you don't need to? Because in manufacturing, you can see the
Essentially, well, I would say maybe it's because you don't need to, but for a different reason, is that you can use magic in manufacturing because it's highly repetitive. And once you learn the magic recipe, you can stick with that for 20 years. There are no real perturbing forces that cause you to have to reevaluate what you're doing. Whereas, in product development, you might be getting along with Scrum just fine and things with your 2-week sprints, and then you start having, a competitor that's doing daily code pushes, to their product and things, and you start discovering that that method that worked so well is starting to fall short.
So, anti-fragility, I got to ask the question. That I found that really enlightening, but I think it'll be good for the listeners to hear a little more about it, because that's the first time I've actually been introduced to it myself. I'll own up to that. And just rung a bell with me. So anti-fragility.
It's old to me, Tony. I learned it last week in Melbourne.
Oh my God. Okay. Yes. So for our listeners, I think, how would you put anti-fragility in a few sentences, if possible?
Well, I'd say I think Taleb's definition is probably as good a one as we'll find, which is that his notion that we tend to think of fragile systems as ones that get worse outcomes in the presence of variability, and robust systems as ones that are the opposite of fragile because they don't deteriorate in the presence of variability. And Taleb's view is that no, the actual opposite of a system that deteriorates in the presence of variability is one that gets better outcomes in the presence of variability. And I'll give you one little sort of example I use to frustrate manufacturing people when I talk about this issue, is that I ask the manufacturing people, say, it's always good to have low variability. I said, okay, let's try something out. We're gonna try an experiment out. I have 10 runners. They all have the same mean running speed. Which one are you gonna bet on to win the race? The one that has the higher standard deviation in their running times, or the one that has the lowest standard deviation? And they invariably will have to confront the issue of the one with the highest standard deviation has the largest tail in the race-winning section. And you will win, you'll make more money by betting on, and that is because a race is a classic asymmetric payoff. The one who gets there first wins, and everybody else doesn't.
And probably depends on the amount of cycles that you run of that race too, right? So when you get that payoff.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah.
Which I think is the interesting thing when you're talking about you know, the small batch sizes, and you use the example of the lottery example, which I think is very,
that was a really
easy thing for people to understand with the three digits, and we pay $3 to take the three digits, or $1 to get the first one, and to get that payoff, I think it's something that a lot of people just don't get in that whole idea of why we do things in an iterative way and ask for more regular feedback.
Yeah, and I think people intuit that it's a good thing to do, but they don't really sometimes understand why it is producing better economic outcomes.
And does it frustrate you? I mean, you said you sort of started this in the 80s, and we fast forward to 2015, and you're still sort of talking about the same things. Is it frustrating that things that we've known for so long, in fact, we can trace it all the way back even further, even to the 30s, if we really want to start talking about it. Is it frustrating that we're still making the same mistakes?
Not to me.
Keeps the bank balance going. Okay, we get that.
Scratch that question.
There was a famous physicist named John Wheeler who said, time is what prevents everything from happening at once, and space is what prevents everything from happening to me. Mm-hmm. And everything happening at once is, in some ways, my ego would be delighted if everybody adopted everything I had said, back in the early 80s and things like that. But on the other hand, I can sort of put dinner on the table because there are people who are still figuring it out right now. Mm. So I'm not really, Ray Kurzweil had that expression that the future is already here, it's just unevenly distributed. And that doesn't bother me. It doesn't bother me that the future is unevenly distributed. I have people I have a chance to work with.
Mm. Yeah, I think it's just one of those things that, there's nothing new about any of these things that we're talking about. And even, we've been banging on this podcast for 3 years, on 3 or 4 years now, on Agile, and you're still seeing this adoption curve. Yeah, it might have crossed the chasm, but the amount of people doing it well is a very small percentage.
Yeah.
The interesting thing for me that I see now is that both with Agile and Lean, is it's different groups are starting to assimilate the information and so it's starting to spread. So it's interesting, I spoke at the Lean Summit earlier in the year.
That Lean product, LPPD.
That. Lean Summit was the classes.
Yeah. Okay, that was the one in the US.
Yeah, I know, we had an Australian version. So I spoke of the Australian version, and it was interesting because we were doing a talk on how Agile and Lean actually work together.
Yeah.
Although, interestingly enough, they're really one and the same, but that's okay. That's my version of it. We thought we'd get nobody in there because we were one of the only Agile talks. We had most of the Lean people were in there, and afterwards the response from the Lean people, they just want to know about it. And it's a lot of the Lean companies are looking at for that next thing because they've reached that status where they need something else to take it to the next level. Are you seeing that across, because you see it more across the world than I would?
Yeah. Yeah, no, I often make the comment that I think Agile software people are doing a better job at Lean product development than people with 40 years of experience in Lean manufacturing. And that's because Lean manufacturing people have been infected with the idea that variability is always bad. Whereas Agile software people, have already crossed that bridge of inspect and adapt. When you get new information, your best choice may be to discard the original plan. And I think that not only the huge success that Agile people are having with that mentality, but that is such a breath of fresh air for the traditional Lean manufacturing folks, because the Lean manufacturing approach works really great in a static, repetitive world and things, but people are asking them to bring Lean to other areas of the company.
Yeah.
And they're discovering that, the stop the line, just does not play, sort of one programmer makes a mistake by not initializing a pointer and we're going to pull the siren and gather all the programs together and talk about the importance of pointers and things like that. Is that, in Lean manufacturing, failure of one item is a very strong predictor that the next item coming off that machine is also going to be bad. Not true in writing code.
Yeah.
And an economic one as well, because you've only got a certain amount of time in the line before you start losing money, and people all the way down the line are not doing anything either, right? Which we don't have in software.
Yeah. So I think the answer is that some of the approach that's being used in agile software and lean product development is actually a breath of fresh air for some of the traditional lean manufacturing folks.
So one of the things I think some of the traditional lean manufacturing guys, when they start to get into the software development, the product development area, is, as you said, for them, standardization is everything,
right?
And reducing the different types of waste. But the one thing that they find hard to cope with is that, as you said, in the manufacturing, it's very standard. But when you're talking about software, the blip in the radar or the ghost in the machine, as I talk to people about, is the human, right? And you cannot standardize the daylights out of the human, or you can't take away that, or you kill the innovation. I heard you talk a little bit about that today.
Yeah, well, I think, frankly, that is one of the sources of the variability. But, there are plenty of other sources of variability as well. Even if you eliminate the human element, it would be, in many ways, I'd use the analogy of the internet, right? Is that we can have an internet that is completely automated and things like that, and we're going to have issues of queues and congestion control and things like that. We have to approach designing the internet as a intrinsically stochastic problem. And look at it through the lens of queuing theory, because demand is constantly varying, channel capacity is constantly varying and things. And, a deterministic view of, every internet link should be 100% utilized 100% of the time just wouldn't work. Wouldn't work. it doesn't matter if you can explain it as being the human element and things like that, but frankly, even if you made the human element go away, the fact that we have never done something, we're constantly doing things that we've never done before, is going to introduce a huge amount of variability.
That said, if we could get people downloading Game of Thrones, maybe that would actually be the stop all the queuing on the internet.
Yeah,
not sure about that. One of the things, this came up, I sat in a bit of your tutorial last week, and I'm going to do the full thing this week. But one of the things that I was hearing in questions that were being asked to you both in your tutorial, in fact, even after a couple of your talks, is you talk about the economics and you talk about how you can explain these things. But the thing that most people come back in is they go, well, how do I go back and explain this to my boss? How do I get people down the line? The economics of this are, I guess, an important thing. And you talked about in your workshop about it's about just asking the question.
Yeah.
So where does the listener go who's saying, look, I've read the book, I've seen the movie, but how do I get people to listen?
Well, there's sort of one approach I use sometimes that's a little bit cheeky, but
yeah, it's only us three here.
it works. So I say, you need to get a volunteer to talk to the manager. You sort of probably have heard me say that, before you do an economic analysis, you need to benchmark what your intuition is, right? So, when you do a cost of delay calculation, the first time people see the number, they're going to say, wow, that's a big number. Is it really accurate? Can you do it accurate to three significant digits and things? And the answer to that question is actually not, the competition is not, in fact, accuracy of three significant digits. The competition is the way you make the decision today when you decide to trade cycle time for something else of value. And so I always tell people, benchmark your organization. Get 10 people in the room working on a program who all are in a position to delay it. Ask them to write down a sheet of paper what it will cost your shareholders if the product was delivered 30 days late, and then calculate the range of that number, and it typically it's going to be 50 to 1. Now, that exercise can be an extremely important way of getting top management interested in cost of delay. Because what you do is you go to top management and you say, look, we're making decisions in engineering that affect cycle time, decisions that are worth hundreds of thousands of dollars, and we have no clue what we're doing. And then managing directors say, well, surely I pay you guys so much money, you must have some clue what you're doing. You say, no, we have data that proves we have no clue what we're doing. You know, we interviewed team A, team B, team C. We asked them what they thought was the correct price to pay for a week of cycle time on their project. We had a 100-to-1 range on team A. We had an 81 range on team B. We had a, 50-to-1 range on team C. And we said, now, you know, you as managing director don't like us to be bringing you problems without solutions. So here are a couple possible solutions. One is we continue to guess. Two is we have really smart people calculate the cost of delay. And since we know software engineers are really smart people, we'll have software engineers calculate the cost of delay. And three is we have finance people calculate the cost of delay. And you say, you know, yeah, we're just engineers. We don't know which of these three choices makes the most sense, but you're a highly paid managing director. You could probably figure out which one made the most sense. And I say this only half in jest because I think if you try to get traction by just going to the finance department saying, we need you to do work for us, they say, that sounds like work to me. I've already got enough work to do. I think what you need to do is you need to go the level above finance and say, here are the choices that we're making that we do not have adequate decision support information to make good choices. That will be causing choices to be made that cost us money. We can prevent those expensive errors if we end up spending a little time estimating what the cost of delay is on our projects. And to the tune where you can get to the point where it takes 15 minutes to do a cost of delay. When you go down the learning curve and things like that, it's not an 8-week exercise. It's, you know, sit down for an hour and calculate stuff.
And is it frustrating that, you know, agile methods have, you know, for the most part been a bottom-up from the delivery side? Is the problem that it's not getting to that middle management layer? I mean, you know, you come from an MBA background, but, you know, is there a misunderstanding at that level, or is it just the developers aren't talking to the management?
No, I think there is a misunderstanding at the middle management level, and I think that it is sort of one of the major birth defects of Agile, which is it sort of eliminated the economic gene. So it was a notion of this is a philosophical system, this is not an economic system. We should not be talking to managers about economics and things.
Well, let's give them philosophy, they'll never understand that.
It's just been this attitude of, you know, look, just go away, stick pizzas under the door, and we will give you good software. And that, unfortunately, that philosophy works well bottoms up. Because you're doing things that are under your control. Yeah. But ultimately, you're going to have to engage with the people who control the resources of the organization. Mm. And if you can't speak their language, you are really at a disadvantage. Is that, you know, because they will constantly ask you the question, how do I make money by doing this? Yeah. And if all you can do is wave your hands and say this is a good thing to do, successful companies do this. Mm. You just don't get traction in the executive suite because they have other options, right? It's, you know, do I hire another salesman in Victoria, or do I end up giving you sort of resources to add a scrum master to a team, things like that? Well, they know what they get in return for hiring another salesman. They get a bunch of hand waving when asked, what will I get with the extra scrum master? And so, you know,
not just hand waving, cards on walls.
Yeah, cards on walls. Yeah.
People standing in circles.
No, post-it notes on a wall.
Yeah, yeah. So I think the time has come that, you know, if you want to push it through to higher levels of management, you got to speak the language they're interested in. Mm. And, you know, as soon as you see little dollar signs appearing in their eyes, you know you got their attention. That's life.
Yeah.
That's life in the C-suite.
Absolutely.
Yeah, that's the enterprise level thing. And that comes down to, you know, having the right metrics, the right numbers, being able to give them the facts to make the fact-based decisions, right?
Yeah, I think so.
And I think we're... Agile's quite good at generating that information. They just don't know how to use it, which is what I see a lot of as well.
Yeah, yeah.
And I think Craig and myself and our compatriot, we've spent a lot of time over the period of time educating around that. But right. I think the question I want to ask you is if Craig and I were going to do that, what's the one tip you'd give us is the easiest way to introduce that to them?
To introduce sort of quantitative-based decision-making?
Mm-hmm. I didn't promise it was going to be an easy question.
No. I don't consider it to be that impossible, I think. Particularly in a multi-project environment, I think one of the things you can do is find one project manager who wants to have an economic model, who wants to work with finance and to understand their economics and things. Because what will tend to happen is that they will be competing for resources with other pieces of the organization. And when the decision is made of who goes first, the project manager with the cost delay is going to say, my cost delay is $100,000 a month. And the managing director is going to go to the other project and say, what's your cost delay? And they'll say, well, we don't have one, but it would be really big if we had one, and things like that. And so it will be the guy who, with the numbers, who ends up winning. And then what happens is the guy who loses on that deal says, you know, I think I'd like to get a cost delay that has been approved by finance as well. You know, I'm at a disadvantage competing for resources because I cannot communicate my needs as effectively as somebody who has finance signed off on what their cost of delay is. And so I find it's a nice way of driving a wedge into the organization because you want to create a situation where the person who is using the new idea is getting better outcomes than the person who isn't.
And it's the key to getting those numbers, you know, like we're talking about the fact that continuous flow is important. That has to be the same thing with these numbers, because the person who goes off and spends 12 weeks getting those numbers has fallen in the same trap as the trapper truck piece of product.
Well,
problem, right?
I mean, I actually tell people, I said, you know, there's really a very natural place to do that, is that when you're starting a project, somebody has done a pro forma P&L saying, here's how much we're going to spend on this, this is what we're going to get in return. And if you do no financial projections in your business plans, then you've got a different problem to fix, right? No organization I work with today has more resources than they have opportunities. You have to have some way of getting the opportunities to stand in line. And from a shareholder perspective, choosing the ones that produce the best long-term return for the shareholders is not a bad approach. And so if you don't have business plans, you're really, you know, throwing darts at your projects. But, you know, once you have the business plans, what I like to do is I just embed another paragraph in the business plan and say, you know, the business plan says, here's how much money we make if everything goes according to plan. And then I just say, add one more paragraph that says, here's what happens if we miss the sell price, if we miss the unit volume, if we miss the target cost, if we miss the schedule. And you just get it embedded in the business plan. It just becomes institutionalized that a business plan contains this information. And you then have a finance blessed cost of delay for every major project. And you don't have to establish a ministry of economic modeling to do it. You just end up saying, let's build it in, append it to our existing business planning process. One more paragraph in the business plan.
Any last questions from you, Tony?
Yeah, the only other question I got is a bit of a strange one. It's around the big stick, ROI. Mm-hmm. I hear it. ROI. What's the ROI? And for me, I think it's become to the point now where ROI is meaningless in a lot of companies. What's your thoughts on that?
Well, I personally end up tending to use life cycle pre-tax profit. That's been, you know, historically much more useful for me. And that's because in general, the investment, when you do ROI properly, you're taking into account all of the balance sheet accounts. You're not just taking into account the investment that you make in R&D expense. When you take the investment in all of the balance sheet accounts, you don't see big changes in the I relative to different revenue streams, because the in fact, what you'll tend to see is that the fixed assets, actually, what you'll see is accounts receivable, accounts payable will tend to be the biggest single factors in the I equation that you have. It's not even going to be fixed asset intensity or the amount of money you spend on R&D. I mean, people are spending less than 5% of sales on R&D. It's not a major factor in the P&L. So if you did ROI possibly, you'd end up discovering that that approach to doing I doesn't really produce any changes in the answer. So I usually try to get people to focus on cumulative before tax profit, which is something that everybody can relate to pretty easily. I mean, I can go to the rank beginner and say, okay, this is the amount of pre-tax profit we make every year. And between when we start this program until when we end it, this is the total amount of pre-tax profit that is delivered to the company that we have are able to either distribute to shareholders or to spend on other things. And it has a great, it's much less opaque than ROI. And I can make, you know, good technical reasons why it is much more useful than ROI as well.
Fantastic. Great.
My last question is, for someone who's listening to this who hasn't perhaps picked up the book before, I mean, it's chock full. I think 175 odd different things to go and learn about, which are always when people, I tell that to people, they sort of raise their eyebrows. But if people are going to dabble into two or three of them, where would you tell them to start?
I would actually just tell them a good place to start is actually a chapter that doesn't have a lot of principles in it, which is chapter one, which is a free download. Mm-hmm. And that at least talks about, you know, here's what's wrong with what we're doing today. Mm-hmm. Now, I think the problem with which principles end up becoming most useful for an individual company, as much as I had a worldview that the first thing you need to do is the economics and then the queuing and then you need to look at the interventions you make to reduce queues, I kept seeing people come out of my classes and they would just grab onto the one that felt like it was a tree that was ready to be pushed over. And so they would jump on visual control boards, or they would jump on WIP constraints, or they'd jump on batch size reduction. And you say, well, wait a minute, that doesn't fit into this overall framework and things like that. And they said, but it's what we want to do. And then they do it, and they get a lot of savings from it. They save millions of dollars. And I say, no, no, but you weren't allowed to save millions of dollars by doing the thing out of order, things like that. No, I mean, at the end of the day, I think if they ring the cash register by picking something up, then it was a good choice. And I think the problem is that my evidence is people are grabbing, there's more than one door into the room. People are sort of going through the door that feels most comfortable for them. And there's no evidence that they're slitting their throat by doing that.
Mm. But I would have to imagine that there's a lot of benefit from looking at the reducing your batch size by looking at your queuing.
Oh, yeah, yeah. No,
if you're really struggling to go, where do I go from chapter one?
Yeah, yeah. You know, I mean, there's a lot of things that I consider be low-hanging fruit. One is put in place visual control boards because it makes you aware of where the inventory is, I think. I think the economic model helps enormously for a lot of things, although that's a harder thing to do. I think the batch size reduction, virtually guaranteed your batch size is too large. You can just brute force cut batch size by 33% and you know, you have 99.9% 0.9% chance that you're going to produce economic benefits. WIP constraints are another one that you can just jump on very quickly. I sort of show people in the book and the classes that, you know, if you put a WIP constraint in at twice the average WIP of the unconstrained system, you're going to see very little blocking and you're going to see a significant reduction in cycle time. Mm. So, you know, low downside, high upside, and it has an undo button on it. If you don't like what happened, you can go right back to the same WIP level you had before. Mm. So there are a set of very easy things that people can grab onto. That and my personal preference is actually that the first thing the first knob I would actually turn, not to get an understanding of the system, but to actually affect the bottom line, is batch size. Mm-hmm. That's always the first one I would do. Because batch size smooths out the flow, it reduces the bottleneck behavior of the system, it prevents variances from accumulating the way they do in large batch systems. So I would probably put on the top of my list batch size reduction.
Excellent. Well, I think there's so many more questions we could ask you. We start page one and keep our way through it. But it's been an absolute privilege having you back in the country, Don, and fantastic to spend a few moments with you. So thanks very much for your time. If people want to find out more information about you and what you do, where's the best place for them to find that out?
Google it.
Yeah. Reinerston with an R.
Actually, they don't even have to spell it right, is that it'll probably show up. But, you know, principles of product development flow, that works. But
you
could Google lean product development flow, and it would be hard not to find me.
And as Craig said in his intro today, it's one of those books that, you know, as one of our icons here said, do yourself a favor, go out and get that, read it. Read it again, and then read it again, because it takes a while to get through.
Yeah.
And try some
shelf,
of the...
Wait for someone to steal it, like in my copy. So I have to go over. So I think you've got about 10 copies out of me, Don, from the ones that have been stolen off my shelf. So I've got my Kindle now, so until someone steals my iPad.
And don't try... Sorry, I was just going to steal Craig's iPad. No. And make sure you try something that's in the book. I mean, you know, for me, that's the thing.
Reason it was broken into 175 little batches is those are all things that I believe individually add value. So it's not like the Ten Commandments where you need to do all 10 things to get to heaven and things like that.
I think we would have been very disappointed if you had just had 10 in there, because you would have just gone completely against your whole small flow, small batch, batch size for the description. Well, again, it's been an absolute pleasure spending time with you, Don. And
thank you
very much.
Thank you for asking me.
And what do we always say, Tony?
Viva la revolution.
Yeah, we got a
Threw me out.
Thank you.
Okay, good.